You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places and the pot shops of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. In June of last year, thieves broke into Cornerstone Wellness Cannabis Dispensary in Eagle Rock. They got away with a significant amount of product and caused thousands of dollars in damage. What happened to Cornerstone, though, isn't an isolated incident.
It's quite alarming. I would say it's probably like 70% of the dispensaries have had at least attempted robberies. It's a huge number.
That 70%, by the way, is an estimate based on industry knowledge by the owner of Cornerstone Wellness. He only agreed to speak to KCRW if we granted him anonymity. He's worried about being recognized and robbed again. According to LAPD public data obtained by Crosstown, our data partners on this story, crimes at licensed cannabis shops have risen sharply this year. From January through September, there were 151 crime reports, putting LA on a record pace. The high all of last year was 165. Legal cannabis is a new industry, and it's still trying to shed the stigma of its illegal past. That's creating challenges for legal operators. Reporter Mary Carrion's been covering the cannabis industry and digs into the story from right here.
Criminals may assume that cannabis businesses are filled with cash because it's a cash business. But businesses remove cash daily or secure it in a vault. So the main lure of robbing a legal cannabis business is to steal weed products and flip them on the unregulated market. The two cannabis business owners I spoke with agreed to talk as long as we didn't identify them or just use their initials. When thieves broke into Cornerstone Wellness in Eagle Rock last June, they left behind fingerprints, blood, earbuds, and a phone with the name of one of the suspects. The security cameras even caught images of the getaway car with the suspects' faces and their voices. Yet, the crime still hasn't been solved.
We provided that information to the Northeast Division of the Police Department. I can't even get them to call me back. We also have their vehicle. It was a Mercedes parked right here on camera as well. So, you know, that part of it's quite frustrating for us.
Frustrating for obvious reasons, and also because the city has an added incentive to keep cannabis businesses safe. Traditional retail businesses in LA pay about 1.25% of gross retail sales in taxes to the city. Cannabis businesses pay 10%.
The city of Los Angeles is our business partner, basically. They make more money off of Cornerstone than my business partner and myself do. And yet, when we have an issue like this, there's just no follow-up.
Chris Eggers is a member of the Cannabis Business Association and owner of a security and risk management firm.
For our clients and the folks that we've been asked to help out with and various other groups that we volunteer our time within, do feel to some degree that law enforcement is not giving them the same amount of attention that other retail businesses are.
When we reached out to the LAPD, they connected us to Police Captain Ahmad Zarakhani from the Gangs and Narcotics Division. We communicated via email. He says they have slower response times because LAPD staff has shrunk over the past 2 years by about 1,000 people. But he says they do not discriminate against cannabis businesses. Zarakhani says they prioritize violent crimes over property crimes, and they give higher priority to cases where they have evidence, which doesn't explain what happened at Cornerstone Wellness, where they have plenty of evidence. Captain Zarakhani said he couldn't comment about that case. To be fair, data shows that robberies and burglaries at legal cannabis businesses go unsolved at nearly the same rate as all break-ins in the city. But it's not just dispensaries getting hit. SG owns a legal cannabis distribution business in Long Beach. It was broken into once in December of last year and again in May of this year.
People have a lot less to lose, and they're a lot more brazen.
In December, thieves used a sledgehammer to break in around 3 a.m. They hopped over a security gate, scaled the side of a building, and entered through the roof. Long Beach PD came 5 minutes later, and after a 10-hour standoff, they arrested the suspects. The police didn't come in time to catch anyone during the burglary in May when thieves stole money from the safe, according to Long Beach PD records.
This group seemed to be a lot more professional, knew where they're going, had the right tools, and ended up actually succeeding their attempts.
SG says he hasn't heard anything from the police, The Long Beach police told us that two men fled the scene before they arrived and that the case remains open. They also told us they don't discriminate against cannabis businesses. SG told us it's up to him to protect himself, which means bolstering security.
24-hour security is really expensive between my two facilities. Right now, I'm paying about $30,000 a month.
SG also says he has gotten little help from his insurance company.
They just, no support, really. And fighting for it, I'm not expecting anywhere near full damages. It's just more loss on our end.
The owner of Cornerstone Wellness in Eagle Rock says the answer is better enforcement.
If there was more follow-up, I think that perhaps some of these people would get caught. And then hopefully that dissuades people from doing this in the future.
California Governor Gavin Newsom recently announced that the state will spend $267 million to help 55 local law enforcement agencies expand enforcement against robbery and larceny. The LAPD and the LA County Sheriff's Department will get money from this program. The legal cannabis operators we spoke to for this story are hopeful the money will help police help them. For KCRW, I'm Mary Carrion.
By the way, we want to give a special thanks to Christina Scarball and our partners at Crosstown who helped make this story possible. You can see more of the data on cannabis crimes at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. There's more on this story and more from the data that Crosstown got at the website, kcrw.com/GLA.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. You can't go very far in LA without someone talking about the horror that's unfolding in the Middle East. An attack launched over the weekend by Hamas, which governs the occupied territory of Gaza, killed hundreds of Israelis inside Israel. The United States officially labels Hamas a terrorist organization. Israel responded to the attacks with a bombing campaign of its own, killing hundreds of Palestinians inside Gaza. The retaliation is only expected to escalate. Los Angeles is home to the second largest Jewish population outside of Israel. It's also home to Palestinians and many other Arab Americans, each community with family and friends in the region, and many of them watching helplessly what's happening so far away. Rabbi Susan Goldberg is with the Jewish spiritual community called Nefesh. She was formerly with the Wilshire Boulevard Temple. Rabbi, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Salam al-Mariati is president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Thank you for coming on, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Rabbi, let me start with you. So many Jewish people here in LA have family or friends in Israel. What are you hearing from the people whom you're with, your congregants, and how are you helping them through this situation?
It's a devastating time. It's hard to find words right now. The community is in deep mourning. The attack from Hamas was just so awful. House-to-house slaughter, open fire at music concerts, dragging old people and toddlers into being hostages. It's horrific. And as you said, you know, there are many, many people with family in Israel. You know, the Jewish community worldwide is so small, and we're connected to the folks who are there. And so, and, you know, I have a couple congregants whose two cousins are being held right now as hostages. So it's very, very alive for our community. And one of the things that people have expressed is it's so odd to be walking around in the world, and most of the world is going on as usual here in Los Angeles, but the Jewish community of Los Angeles and all over the world are just in shock.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I'm sure there, you know, there is that, as you said, watching as sort of life goes on here in LA and here in the United States, but this sense of helplessness, right, for
yes.
Many, when you're thinking about how far away it is, do you know anyone who's maybe planning to go there to help? Can you even get there?
Yeah, there are a couple people in our community who in particular have elderly parents who are trying to get there to help take care of them because they are staying in bomb shelters and needing help. And there's also the fear, the incredible fear and insecurity about what's coming next. You know, this is just atrocious violence that just happened. Unfortunately, the ways that people often react is in retaliatory violence as well. And so just worried about the violence that is also happening to innocent civilians in Gaza as a result, and then the violence that will come back, and then the violence that will go back and forth. And so also a lot of what our community is trying to do is to really hold hope and pray for peace, that this just incredible atrocity that Hamas committed in Israel doesn't then lead to just ongoing killing in the region.
Yeah. Salam, I want to pick up on something that the rabbi just said. How do you communicate this difference between Palestinians who don't want occupation, who want to live in peace and freedom, and from what happened over the weekend? Because it is, as the rabbi said, innocent people in Israel, obviously, who have been killed, but also innocent people in Gaza who didn't plan those attacks on Israel, who are suffering the most.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you asked that question. First of all, I just want to say how honored I am to be on the same show with Rabbi Susan Goldberg. She's been a friend and a colleague and well-respected rabbi in the Muslim community. So I really appreciate being with her. I agree with her on everything that she said in terms of the horror that came from Hamas. That's reprehensible. It's horrific. And targeting civilians, of course, in both of our faiths is not allowed. It's forbidden. And unfortunately, the way events have turned for the last, I would say, 56 years since the occupation began in Gaza and the West Bank, is that the only relevant groups have been the violent groups, that we have erased the voices of the people. The civilians, as you alluded to, don't have a voice in this, and so they're going to suffer even more. And I'm just worried that after the rubble will be witnessed by all of us, that what will rise from the ashes will be more extremism. And we have this vicious cycle that is targeting civilians. And at the end, we have to figure out a way to get back to the table, because the only resolution is going to be done through political negotiations. But I'm just afraid, like, we're estimating tens of thousands of Palestinians now are going to be slaughtered as a result of what happened over the weekend and the Israeli actions and the U.S. support for the military actions. I just read a statement by the Israeli defense minister that refers to Palestinians in Gaza as human animals. And so this demonization and dehumanization of Palestinians has been actually going on for quite some time. And what Hamas does, unfortunately, but effectively, brings attention to the situation while the rest of the world really has ignored the sentiment of the Palestinian people for all this time.
You've spent much of your career working to bridge this divide between people, to help people all over L.A. and the Southland and really all Americans understand the Muslim community and to build bridges between people of different faiths. How successful has that work been, do you think, here in Southern California in recent years? How do you do that?
I believe that Los Angeles is a special example, is an important example for the rest of the country, and the success and the strides that we have made on interfaith collaboration and cooperation. Of course, when it comes to domestic issues, we are there for the Jewish community when there is anti-Semitism, and the Jewish community will actually form a human defense chain around our mosques when there are attacks against Muslims. So I believe that that has been the result of years of work. I don't see that in Chicago or Washington or New York. I see it in Los Angeles. So I believe we do have something special here that I would like to extend to the rest of the country in any way possible.
Rabbi, I don't know how the situation is at Nefesh, but I know that security is a big issue at temples and synagogues all over L.A. Are folks in the Jewish community afraid that the war over there could lead to violence and attacks here?
Yeah, I mean, this is coming out of a time where we've really experienced a real increase in anti-Semitic hate incidents in this period just before and around the High Holy Days, which we just had. There were a lot of these swatting incidents where people were calling in, reporting that there was a bomb or a gunman inside of a Jewish gathering. And there wasn't one, but what it did is it brought the police and in, and it, you know, terrorized the people inside. And is also a thing that I don't think a lot of Angelenos are aware of. And so, yes, there is fear very much inside the Jewish community about what kinds of anti-Semitic attacks this might bring. And really, I can't, you know, say enough what it's been like for the community and people of all ages, you know, seeing the images and the videos and hearing people on the phone or getting texts from loved ones who are saying, you know, they're coming in, they're shooting at me. It's just a time of real trauma. And I want to say, in this work that we do together in Los Angeles for interfaith connection and solidarity, you know, some of the very first people who reached out to me to check on how I was doing, how our community was doing, are, you know, my Muslim colleagues, and in particular Palestinian Muslim colleagues, who reached out to just express their horror at what was happening. As Salam was saying, this killing of innocence is not in either of our traditions, and it is just a really, really important time for people to connect with their friends, colleagues, coworkers, and maybe ask if they have family who are going through this. It is really an important time to know what is happening for, as you said, one of the largest Jewish communities is here in Los Angeles. And it's very hard when people are feeling unseen for what is happening and for the trauma that's going on.
Rabbi Susan Goldberg with the nonprofit Jewish spiritual group called Nefesh. Salam Amawriyati, president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Thanks to you both for coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. The annual Made in LA Biennial at the Hammer Museum in Westwood provides a sweeping look at some of the best artwork that Los Angeles has to offer. Well, this year's show features 39 different artists from all over the city working across all kinds of media and themes. And here to tell us about just a few of her favorites is our own art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
Well, the first biennial took place 11 years ago. I can't believe it's been that long. Back in 2012, the show that just opened is the sixth installment. It seems to be turning into a real institution, right? I mean, has it changed much over the years?
Yeah, you know, I think the longer an exhibition like this continues, the more of an identity it starts to take on. And now, as you said, it's like an institution. We expect it. We look forward to it. And I think it really becomes a part of the fabric of the city. You know, I think earlier on, the show felt a little more like, oh, it's a who's who of the artists in LA and who's in it, who's not. But I think for me, the longer the show has gone on, it becomes much more clear that each show is also this kind of curatorial statement that each kind of pair of curators are making about how the artists included reflect LA in this moment and this time right now. So each one definitely has its own identity.
All right, so let's dig into the artists. There are 39, as we know. You're going to focus on a couple of them right now, one of whom is Paige Ji-young Moon, originally from Seoul, South Korea, but she's living or has been living in LA, I guess, for more than a decade. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah. So she came here for school to study illustration at Art Center. And it's really interesting to me that she has an illustration background, because seeing her work, they're so, so meticulous. She makes these very exacting paintings that are very technically precise. So you definitely see that kind of background come through. And she typically works at this really kind of small, intimate scale. Her paintings are, you know, about the size of like a piece of computer paper, let's say. But they draw you in with their detail. Each one is like its own little world that you just want to explore, these little microscopic details. And across her work, she's very inspired by day-to-day experiences. So think, you know, like regular mundane moments, but you know, how a particular piece kind of reflects that moment and then the people within it. And they feel almost like a hybrid between landscapes and then kind of narrative storytelling of the people within each scene.
Is there a piece, Lindsay, in the show that really exemplifies Moon's artwork?
Yeah. Oh, there's so many. I mean, I was really drawn to these domestic scenes in the Hammer exhibition. So there are two paintings, one of the artist and then one of the partner, each with kind of their newborn baby. And in one, you see the artist kind of holding their baby, napping in a corner in the baby's nursery, and all of the items of just kind of this messy newborn life just like strewn about the room. And I felt like it just really gave this intimate look of motherhood and really reflects the people within the scene as well. And the one of her partner kind of does the same. He's passed out on the bed of their bedroom, and you really study all of the details of like what's on their bookshelf, what's outside their window. And it sort of creates this really honest and vulnerable portrait that draws you in. So again, it's about the people, but it's also about the spaces that they inhabit.
All right, let's turn to another artist of the show, Michael Alvarez, born and bred in East LA, another artist who uses his work to tell the story of his city, his surroundings, but in a very different way. He started out as a tagger, right? A young tagger.
Yeah, and you know, that definitely comes through in his work, as well as this kind of hometown pride for East LA. It's super palpable. So his paintings are made with a mix of kind of traditional materials like oil paint, but also spray paint. So that kind of graffiti background comes through. And then he also collages onto these paintings with little bits of trash and things kind of found from the places that he paints. And in general, you recognize LA in his work. You know, you see the LA River or neighborhoods that feel very East LA. So, you know, I think similar to Moon's work, is that he does are really about the people and the social dynamics, but also the spaces and the spaces within our city that these people occupy.
And a piece that stood out to you in Alvarez's work?
There's one in particular I just was obsessed with, called Two Foos and a Double Rainbow. And you see these two figures kind of in the lower part of the painting, and they're wearing LA sweatshirts, standing on the edge of what I think is the LA River, kind of by a chain link fence. But what's so interesting is the figures are in this lower part of the painting, and that's where you kind of see the sort of LA landscape. But then most of the painting is actually the sky and this kind of double rainbow and this natural, you know, beautiful event happening in the sky. So again, you get the sense of this social scape. So the painting is as much about nature and place and the natural environment as well as it is about, you know, these two foos or like these people in the scene.
Yeah. And we just had a rainbow actually a few weeks ago here in LA. I remember it. It rained on the west side of town and we had a nice rainbow. A lot of social media about that. Anyway, The Hammer, of course, made in LA, going on right now. Art insider Lindsay Preston Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, he's best known for his series of books featuring Private Eye E.Z. Rawlins, but Walter Mosley has a new book titled Touched, which is a pretty trippy sci-fi novel, and it's set right here in L.A. We'll talk to him tomorrow on GLA. Hope you can check us out online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. While you're there, tell us how you're doing. Share a story idea. Maybe even grab the podcast too, won't you? kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Ted Robbins, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all helped with this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.